This episode of Continuing Mission is brought to you by the wonderful patrons of Trek Film who support us through Patreon. If you love Star Trek discussion, visit patreon.com/trekfilm to find out how you can help and even become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfilm. And we thank everyone for their support.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Continuing Mission, our look at the ways in which fans are keeping Star Trek alive. I'm your host, C. Brian Jones, and the primary focus of this show is on the fan series, or independent productions, that tell new stories set in the Star Trek universe. In this episode, I'm joined by Eric Henry to learn more about his project, Pacific 201, which tackles an entirely unseen era of Star Trek history. Pacific 201 tells the story of how Earth reestablishes itself as a positive interstellar influence after the devastating Romulan War. During the 40 years since the ceasefire was signed, which established the famous Romulan neutral zone and officially ended the war, mistrust and a general wariness of the unknown have continued to plague humanity. But as the children of those who fought in the war grow tired of hiding from the galaxy, Earth begins to regain its confidence and make a new name for itself. This new era is marked by the launch of Earth's new flagship, the Starship Pacific, which will embark on a bold mission towards a mysterious and uncharted region of space. Sound interesting? Well, let's let Eric tell us more about the genesis of the project, plans for production, and much more. Hello, Eric. Thanks for taking some time to come on Continuing Mission today to talk to me about your project, Pacific 201.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk to you because this project I find very interesting because it's unique. You know, one thing that you talk about in your intro video is the fact that you're taking a somewhat different approach to Star Trek. And I think that's great because you need to do that these days, right, to make Star Trek relevant. So I'd like to know, first of all, because anyone who goes to the great lengths that are necessary to make an independent film has to truly love Star Trek. So do you remember when you first became a Star Trek fan?
Yeah, I think that kind of happened. I know it happened before I was 6 years old. I didn't have the privilege of, you know, growing up with Star Trek on the air. I think Star Trek Voyager was on the air when I was that young. But my father did. He tells me he can remember the very first time he watched Star Trek, which was back in 1966. And he's always been a huge fan. And he kind of made sure that my brother and I were also huge fans. We had a lot of original series episodes on VHS and a number of TNG, like recorded off the air bootleg kind of VHS.
Well, I don't really call that bootleg. I used to do that too. That's just, I want to watch this again later and who knows when it's going to be back on back then, right?
Right, right. So we had a number of TNG episodes. Not a lot, not as many as the TOS episodes. And I think we also had The Final Frontier, Search for Spock, and The Voyage Home on VHS as well. So those were like my Star Trek movie experiences, but mostly TOS. So we really did watch those episodes to death. We had this tiny little television upstairs, and that was like the Star Trek television. So that's really been a big part of like the formative years of my childhood and watching Voyager on the air and eventually Star Trek Enterprise. And
interesting. So I'm starting to feel old because you mentioned that Voyager was on the air when you were that age. So how old are you now?
I'm 22.
22. Wow. Okay. I'm almost twice your age. No, I really feel old. Actually, more than twice your age. But that's interesting. And so your father really got you into TOS. That's great. You know, I've tried that with my own kids and haven't had any success. What is it that connected with you about TOS when your dad would show you that?
That really is a difficult question. I mean, I guess there is sort of a whimsical, almost childish appeal to Star Trek. It appeals to some of the baser human instincts, I think, you know, the curiosity and wonder that is kind of natural for a child, I feel. There's not very much cynicism, and TOS really applies to a less cynical audience. Also, I really did kind of latch on to Spock. I'm not really sure what it was about him, but he really was a very kind of like a calm and rational figure that I really appreciated as a child. I'm not sure what it was, but I can always remember.
I kind of had the same experience myself.
Yeah. Like this soothing effect when Spock was on screen. It was like a therapeutic thing. Mm-hmm. So definitely Spock was a big part of that.
Do you remember what the first episode you saw was? Sometimes people can recall that and sometimes not. I cannot myself. I don't remember the very first.
You know what? I feel like it wasn't something that would have made me want to watch again. I think it was something kind of scary for a kid, like The Mark of Gideon or something like that. Like,
yeah, that would be something creepy for a kid. Right?
Something kind of creepy.
Yeah.
I seem to remember being kind of creeped out, but like in a good way.
Okay. So does TOS remain your favorite series, or is there a different series that's your favorite now?
I think TOS is the most rewatchable series for me. It doesn't have all of my most favorite episodes, I don't feel, but as a whole, as a cohesive whole, I think TOS is definitely the one that has the most lasting draw for me.
Yeah, I think that's really unusual for someone who's 22 years old, but that's great. I mean, I think it shows the timeless and the enduring nature of that series.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, tell me a bit about your own background. Now, you've been involved in filmmaking, and I think anyone who watches the preview videos that you've made for Pacific to a One can tell that you have experience and you know what you're doing and you have a vision. So tell me a little bit about the work that you've done up to this point and what interests you most about filmmaking.
Well, I can trace filmmaking back to my father as well. He worked as a photographer, and he actually traveled all over the world, and there was a real romanticism about his job. And I kind of grew up around filmmaking equipment. So I grew up around Star Trek, and I grew up around filmmaking equipment. So I was making movies as early as 6 years old, and I probably made a movie once every year of my life all the way through till college. And in college, I didn't major in filmmaking, but I did study the craft. I took quite a few courses in screenwriting and the technical side, and then most of the jobs I've held so far have been media technicians and, you know, lighting and sound and audio. And, you know, I've been surrounded by that kind of thing. So there is definitely a standard to uphold.
So those films that you were making as you were growing up, what kind of films were those?
Nothing that will ever see the light of day. I mean, mostly the other thing that I grew up with would be Lego.
Okay.
And we made a lot of, me and my brother, when I say we made a lot of Lego films, and they're not even like the high tech kind of like stop motion Lego films. We were literally just moving the figures with our hands in front of the camera. So
but you
that
had a
was
story
kind of,
behind that, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. That's the theme. We had continuing episodes, and they were not short movies. You know, we had like 30 to 40 minute movies.
Oh, wow.
And you know, we thought they were gripping. I haven't watched them recently. So
one of these days, when you become a famous filmmaker, there will be a special Blu-ray release of the Lego films that you made.
Yeah, maybe. Or after I'm dead and I can't object to it.
I see. Well, let's talk about what you're making right now. One question, because you are taking a different approach to Star Trek, you know, you're not trying to recreate the original series. You're not trying to recreate anything that exists on the timeline in canon. You are filling in the gaps, which is something that, you know, Matthew and I talk about a lot when we would do literary treks in the past, how the books fill in the gaps. So you're telling a new story, but visually it also has its own identity. And you went out, I know you studied naval ships, you studied the space shuttle, you did all of this stuff to create something that's unique for your film. So when you go to that length, why Star Trek? Why not just create something that's completely yours, where you own that IP and, you know, you can send it to film festivals or you can monetize that? Why Star Trek?
Right. Well, I feel like a lot of the lengths that we're going to for, you know, the visuals and the unique look is actually more because it's Star Trek.
Okay.
We feel like Star Trek really deserves a little bit of a fresh take and something that that's really relevant and kind of grounded and something that looks plausible and something that looks like it's actually our future. And I feel like, you know, I really love Star Trek and I really think that there's something meaningful to contribute with something new and something fresh with Star Trek. So yeah, I could make something totally original and I've done, and not as much in filmmaking, but I have done a lot of writing and visual design in my own kind of IP world. But I really want to give something to the Star Trek community. And I feel like this is what, when I think of what I want to see in Star Trek, this is it. So the whole new visual look is kind of, it's because it's Star Trek to me anyway.
One thing I notice in, especially the beginning of your preview trailer, and I don't mean this in a way that you're mimicking, but just stylistically, it has more of that Ronald D. Moore Battlestar Galactica feel to the space scenes, as opposed to what we're accustomed to in Star Trek, which is a feel that I really like because it's more realistic. It's not that squeaky, clean, polished feel that we've gotten over the years in Star Trek. Is BSG an influence on you, or is that coincidental? And what does that style mean to you?
I could say it's maybe a little bit coincidental. I really do like the, you know, the reimagined BSG. I like the original BSG too, but mm-hmm. you know, just a shout out there. But the reimagined BSG, it does have a much more harder sci-fi feel to it, even though it's still quite fantastic. The overlaps are more probably coincidental, accidental. A lot of the style of how we're framing and shooting the space scenes and how we're lighting them and stuff like that is actually based on like a NASA file footage.
Okay.
We go on, you know, the NASA website. They've got a lot of videos and you watch like docking procedures with, you know, the Endeavor with the International Space Station. And it must be really hard to hold the camera still in zero G.
Oh,
like
yeah.
When you watch, like I've gotten feedback on the shaky cam for Pacific 201 and like, it's not, we're not doing that stylistically so much as we want it to look like how it really looks like when you film spacecraft in space.
Yeah.
And it's very wobbly because it's either bolted to the spaceship or it's floating around the inside of the spaceship. And it's probably pretty hard to control, you know? So that's a lot of the actual stylistic inspiration actually comes from like the literal real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and again, I like that because you feel like you're there, right? I mean, as much as I love Star Trek and the style that we've gotten over the years, there is a certain disconnect between the realism of if you were really there. Either that, or they have got some just really incredible camera stabilization technology in the future.
Yeah, I mean, in the future, you'd probably have it. But the shots are definitely idealized.
Yeah.
And it I feel like there's a more tactile connection if you can feel like it was really actually filmed.
Yeah, there is. Well, I want to come back to the ship design, but before we do that, I want to talk about the story a little bit. Now, the background to this story is that the Romulan War ended, humanity was very beaten up, and they've kind of turned inward again, and they've decided they're not going to explore the stars. They're very war-weary. And then things change. There's a new flagship, the Starship Pacific, and we're going to head back out into space again. Is there anything in the real world or in history that is influencing that story? Is this something that you've just always thought about specifically in terms of Star Trek that you wondered what happened between the Romulan War and then the future where the Federation was strong again?
Yeah, I can't really think of a specific historic situation where something similar happened. But I do think of the dawn of the 20th century and post, I've studied a lot of art in my field of study. And when you study like post World War I art, there's this kind of sadness to it. As opposed to like pre like 1900s and earlier, where there's kind of like warm, fuzzy flowers and houses and people, and then you have World War I and art, especially in Europe, becomes really gray and it becomes really angular and scary, because the world becomes a much grayer, angular, and scary kind of place. And I kind of feel that's sort of realistically what would happen after the Romulan War. And like people have said, oh, but the Federation gets founded. It's a new era of optimism and stuff like that. And I feel like even the founding of the Federation, it's not going to bring back people's dead sons and daughters. It's not going to bring back people's dead parents. And when all the dust settles, people are going to think, what did we really do? We're allies with all these new worlds, but thousands of people are dead, you know, millions of people are dead, you know, between the Zindi conflict all the way through the Romulan War. What good has really come other than the Federation? And I feel like there is a lot of, realistically speaking, there would be a lot of questioning, a lot of self-doubt, where humanity would think, what are we really doing out there? What is really the purpose of exploration and stuff like that? So that's a huge basis for the climate of the movie.
Well, at the end of Enterprise, after the Zindi conflict, you see that on Earth. There's a xenophobia that takes over, right. And people feel like, should we really be out there? So you're extending that, like, they overcome that, but then there's the Romulan War. And after that, they look back, Romulan War, Zindi conflict, do we really, really need to be out here? So it's like a progression of what we've already seen.
Right, it's like Strike Two.
Now, is the story itself, that's a dark time after the war, obviously. Right. Now, that's the backstory to Pacific 201. Is Pacific 201 itself a dark story, or is it a hopeful story?
It's much more a hopeful story, because it's the children of the really pessimistic people after the war, where they never lived through the war. Mm-hmm. They never lived through the Zindi conflict. They never lived through the xenophobic uprising on Earth, or the Terra Prime stuff. They're more eager to resume this dream that the Federation had, this, you know, in some of the promotional art, I've said that the dream of the Final Frontier, you know, join the dream of the Final Frontier. The Pacific is kind of a representation of that dream. It's, you know, even in the name. So like that, this is representing a new era of optimism, and it's more the actual start of the more optimistic Star Trek that we get in TOS and onwards.
Well, speaking of Pacific, the ship design is something else I wanted to talk about, because more so than any ship that I can recall seeing in any rendition of Star Trek, the Pacific really takes cues from our current naval vessels, I feel, and the look of battleships. And it's interesting to see the very familiar Star Trek elements, like the saucer section and the nacelles, along with these other elements. So what led you to that design?
I feel like, okay, it was like maybe 2 years ago when I first came up with the very, very, very prototypical story concept. And the original story concept was that it was really going to be like early exploration. Mm-hmm. I was actually imagining something that was more pre-Enterprise, okay, where the ship would be like a really prototypical kind of ship, and I wanted it to really evoke sea exploration. And I kind of scrapped that timeline idea, and I moved the time to something that was more interesting from a storytelling perspective. But I did keep kind of that romantic maritime vibe, because I mean it's not something that ever leaves Star Trek. You know, they have that big ship wheel that room in Star Trek V.
Yeah, the naval influence throughout Starfleet, right, is always there, but the ship design is not so much influenced, right, by naval vessels.
And I felt like, you know, a ship that's has a seagoing name might have a seagoing motto. Mm-hmm. You know, they have like those mottos, or it might have seagoing aesthetic. And I thought it would just be more than anything, the ship elements of the design are more stylistic, more to evoke that seagoing feel, like it's literally a ship in the stars. And I thought that was kind of romantic.
Have you thought about the structure of Starfleet at this point? Do you see it as being closer to the Navy of today than the Starfleet is that we see in Kirk's time or Picard's time?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt like after the Romulan War, Starfleet is the Navy.
Okay.
It's just the Navy in space. It doesn't have a scientific or an exploratory element because all that becomes unnecessary when people are getting killed. So Starfleet becomes the Navy, but we do still have the United Earth Space Probe Agency, the USPA, you know, that we hear about in TOS and very vaguely referenced in Enterprise and Voyager. That still exists, and that is what is still like Starfleet, how we would understand it. They're the ones doing exploratory work, but they're not really a very well-funded organization. You know, they might get like the mothball ships to do some scientific research, but nobody really cares about them. What's really important to Earth at that time is, you know, border security and resources and trade and not exploration. So there's still a little bit of that going on, but the Pacific represents the first time that a Starfleet ship is again having an exploratory role like, you know, the NX-01 did. So there's actually a little bit of it's actually a story point where you have Starfleet officers trying to work with USPA astronauts, essentially. Okay. And there's kind of a little bit of, not true friction, but there are difficulties to overcome where you have people that are thinking, you know, Earth security, don't trust hostile aliens. And then you have these kind of idealist astronauts who are like, oh, space is wonderful. And there's a little bit of a worldview conflict.
Mm-hmm. While we're still talking about the Navy and ship here a little bit, tell me about this experience of actually visiting naval vessels to prepare for this.
Yeah, that's something I really wanted to do. And it's something I've done in the past already. And I kind of include that in my assessment of like, I've actually toured submarines and I toured the battleship New Jersey that's docked on the Delaware River. And there's really something about touching things and walking through things that you can't get from a photograph. I could look at photographs of battleships and of submarines all day long, but when you're actually sitting in a chair and you feel like, okay, this is where somebody actually works. This is where the, you know, the XO sits and, you know, gives orders and stuff like that. And you get a feeling for how narrow things are and how cramped things are. And then when you watch Star Trek and you feel like these are bigger and more spacious than, you know, seagoing vessels, and they're space vessels, which I feel like should be even more cramped, especially the NX-01, which I really do like the design of the interiors of the ship, but the hallways are really wide and really tall, and they're like three times wider than they are on a naval vessel that's, you know, just as big when you really think about it, as far as the mass of the ship. So like, I really like getting a sense of the materials and this, the utilitarian sense, like, oh, this thing needs to be exposed because you need to actually work on that. You know, in Star Trek, we see people pulling panels off the wall, but in the Navy, there are no panels on the wall. There's stuff.
They're not concerned about the aesthetics of it.
Right.
Right.
Like, we need to be able to fix that without taking anything off. So a lot of that has influenced the design of the Pacific, where there's a lot more exposed stuff than we've seen in Star Trek and stuff like that.
And you also went and you studied the space shuttle. What were you looking for in terms of the space shuttle?
The space shuttle, we were more looking for like the texture of the exterior of the ship and what do real reaction control systems look like. You know, in, you know, TMP and onwards, we see like those yellow blocks on the corners of the corners of the saucer. There's no such thing, but I think
that circle.
Right. I think you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, but when you look at the space shuttle, you see, oh, that's what a real reaction control thruster looks like, or that's what a real thruster looks like.
Yeah.
And what the texture of the hull, I mean, I understand that the space shuttle has a thermal control system, like the skin of the, it's all for thermal control. But I feel like that would still be something that would be applicable even in, you know, 2200. So getting a feel for, you know, obviously you can't touch it. You know, you would get like shot on sight if you touched it. But getting up really close to the space shuttle and seeing what the actual gaps look like and how is the United States printed on the side and stuff like that. You kind of get a feeling for what's really happening there. And it's not just a graphic on a screen.
Well, you talked a little bit about the two different groups of characters, the explorers and then the military-minded people as well. What can you tell me about the characters in Pacific 201, like specifically your crew and how you're populating the story?
We have actually released two character bios so far on our website. We plan on releasing more. We feel like our fans kind of deserve to know mm-hmm. a little bit about who's going to actually, you know, the characters. We don't have anybody actually cast yet, but we do have we're eyeing up some people. I guess I can talk about, there's kind of a trio of characters. We're not really doing what TOS did with, say, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but we're inspired by the fact, like, you have Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and they're definitely the three main characters of TOS. And they all act a certain way when they're all together. But Kirk and Spock act differently with each other than Kirk and McCoy do. And McCoy and Spock act much differently than Kirk and Spock. And
right.
all the way around, there's like pairs of interesting character interactions. So we kind of have this trio where we have the captain, we have the first officer, and we have the science officer. And the science officer is an important character because she is both a Starfleet officer and a USPA astronaut. She's one of the very few dual commissioned people at that time. Now, later, Starfleet will be a combined service, and everybody working in Starfleet is going to be a USPA astronaut as well. But at this time period, this is kind of unheard of. She is both a highly trained scientist and a military personnel, in a sense. So we have the captain, who is much more military personnel, but he has the idealistic mindset of exploration and the final frontier, and he's really excited about, because he was born before any of that. He was born in 2149, I think, and he kind of grew up with the, you know, his very earliest memories mm-hmm. are hopeful optimism right before the Zindi attack.
So he's an older
like
captain, because this is 2200, right? So
yeah, he's in his 50s. Okay. He's not like as young as Kirk, though. I guess he's, I don't know how old Picard is supposed to be in the first season of TNG.
I'd have to go back and look, but I think 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he might be a little younger than Picard, but he's not young. He's not really old either, but we also imagine that people are kind of younger in the future. Mm-hmm. You know, a 50-year-old in the future is more like a mid-40-year-old.
Yeah, or a 30-year-old now, maybe even.
Like a late 30s, early 40s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we might actually end up casting him younger. A lot of our characters, right, we might actually cast younger to reflect this kind of idea about the future, that people might actually look younger than they really are. Anyway, that's beside the point. We have the captain, you know, as I said, he's military trained, but he has this spirit of adventure. And then we have the first officer, who is kind of an oddball, I guess. She's kind of a little bit different because she's supposed to be a incredible prodigy. And she's actually, according to the captain, she's much too young to be an XO. Even though Starfleet thinks that she's perfect for the job, she's, you know, highly qualified. She's really intelligent. But the captain's like, well, you haven't really logged that many space hours. So there's actually kind of this, we have a captain who's older than most of his crew, and then we have an XO that's much younger than the captain, and there's an interesting relationship there. And then we have the XO and the science officer, and they're more the same age. They're both women, and there's an interesting connection there. And then you have the science officer and the captain that have, they still do kind of have an ideological difference. The captain is much more conservative, and the science officer is much more eager. So
it's like the flip of Kirk and Spock then.
Yeah, right. Kind of. Yeah. It kind of is. I mean, I could go on into more characters. Like, we do have a second level of main characters, kind of like how, you know, all Star Trek has. You know, you have like our Scotties, our Sulus, our Chekhovs, like the outer level of main characters. But we kind of want to blur the lines. We feel like it's a little too simplistic to say, like, these are the people that really matter on the ship. We have five people that sit on the bridge all day, and they're mm-hmm. the people who matter. So we actually kind of want to blur the lines. Like, the captain and, you know, the three characters I mentioned, they're probably the main characters, but not by much. everyone kind of has a story to tell. Everyone kind of is important. And we want to bring that out and kind of turn expectations on their head. Like when we have a character go into a dangerous situation, we want the audience to think, oh, they're going to die because, you know, they're not a main character.
Yeah.
But they'll surprise you because not all minor characters are as minor as they would normally be in Star Trek.
Right. What's the crew complement of the Pacific?
We haven't really locked down a number, but it's small. It's like 112,
okay.
I think.
So with that, you really can tell a story where you can have many more people involved. Not like the 1701D where it's like, hey, here are seven people that we see all the time and there are, you know, 1,000 more people right. working, but you rarely ever see them. Unless you need your haircut, right. you go see Mott. So, okay, also while we're envisioning the crew and the ship and Starfleet and everything, costume design is always an interesting conversation that I have with people when they are creating their take on Star Trek, and you have unique uniforms for this time period as well. What was your thought process, and I'm sure it's an ongoing thought process, on the costume design and what Starfleet uniforms are like in 2200?
Yeah, it's definitely an ongoing process. We haven't yet made a final uniform. When I show people the uniforms, I try to include like a clause that says this is a prototype uniform. Right. Because we've actually made two entirely different uniforms so far, two entirely different prototype uniforms. Originally, the idea, you know, way back when it was a pre-Enterprise story, the uniforms were really, like, really 50s, 60s inspired. Like what they were actually wearing in the 50s and 60s, not what they thought we'd be wearing in the 50s and 60s. So it was like a khaki jumpsuit with a very slight bit of division color undershirt peeking through. So it wasn't even like the more cohesive Enterprise uniforms, you know, where it was, you know, the dark blue with the division striping in the uniform. It was kind of like more prototypical, something that looked more put together rather than tailored for the specific mission. Mm-hmm. But when we ended up going for a more halfway between Enterprise and TOS, you feel like, should it be more like Enterprise or should it be more like TOS? And ultimately, we decided it should look more like TOS because the mood is finally starting to point towards TOS. So we thought it needs to evoke the TOS uniforms. So we ended up going with like a pullover, a light pullover with a black turtleneck underneath. And that looks more like the regular TOS episode. When you kind of squint, it has a similar feeling from the TOS uniforms, but not so much like the pilot uniforms. Though I did address that in a recent video where the pilot uniforms, more so than the regular series uniforms, they look like sweaters. Mm-hmm. To me, they look like sweaters.
And by pilot uniforms, you're talking about the cage.
Yeah, right. The cage where no man has gone before. The uniforms look, to me, like sweaters. They have like a ribbed collar.
Yeah,
the material's a little heavier and bulkier than it is in the regular series. So we thought this is a really good opportunity to introduce some more real-world influence to the Star Trek uniforms. So, you know, what they did with Enterprise, essentially they look like they're wearing NASA jumpsuits.
Right.
So we thought we could do our own real world influence with the Pacific costumes where they look like British Navy uniforms. So, and, you know, I don't want to do a disservice, like the Canadian Navy, the South African Navy, they all kind of have this particular kind of uniform that incorporates a pullover sweater, and it has like acrylic shoulder pads and epaulettes. Like it's not like a standard sweater, but we thought we could kind of emulate that sweater look with, you know, the red, the blue, and the yellow division colors, and we feel it looks very Star Trek, but it also looks very real world, and it gives us a lot of flexibility. So we can, for instance, we did a test shot where we have, and it's actually in the Kickstarter video, it's a like a white button-up shirt and a black tie under the sweater, which seems a little heretical, but we did see that sort of styling in Enterprise as well. And we feel like maybe that's not quite gone, that really grounded look. But then you would also have the black undershirt and when they're on the ship. So there's kind of a variety that both points towards TOS and both points back towards us. And it really feels like something, oh, this is us out in space. This isn't some, you know, fantasy humanity in the future. This is literally us. And that's a feeling that I got from Enterprise.
Right.
That really spoke to me. And it's something that I wanted to continue and even maybe intensify in Pacific 201. Cause I feel like that really means something.
Yeah, I agree. That's one thing I love about Enterprise is that feeling that you can see yourself there. It feels like a progression of where we are. And I do think that's important for Star Trek. One other thing I want to ask you about, because a lot of our listeners are very interested in the production side and the technical side. And, you know, like, what kind of cameras do you use? What kind of lenses do you use? What kind of software do you like to use when you're doing your filmmaking? What can you tell me about that?
I can't tell you really specific about, especially about cameras and lenses. We're definitely leaning towards getting Blackmagic Cinema cameras, mainly because they're affordable and they're quite versatile and quite good. You know, we're not going to dump many thousand dollars on a camera that's only marginally better than, say, like a Blackmagic Cinema camera. Most of my experience with cameras has actually been with like prosumer camcorders. With like the, I can't remember. I've used two in my job, but they're big camcorders and they're close to $6,000 and they're quite nice. But, you know, we don't need a $6,000 camera to shoot this movie. We're looking more for budget. You know, producing this film on a budget is important to us, but producing it well is also important to us. We feel like that's a very good middle ground to get something that's more like a $2,000 or $3,000 camera rather than a $6,000 to a $10,000 camera. Also, software, I was born and raised on the Adobe Suite. I've been using it since, you know, as long as I can remember. And I think it's definitely an industry standard, using Adobe Creative Cloud. So all you Adobe fans will be pleased to hear that we do use Adobe products.
Excellent. One other thing, this reminds me, because we're talking about software, one point that you've made, and we'll talk about this a little more when we talk about the Kickstarter, is that you don't want to shoot everything in front of green screens and try to do digital environments. You want to have actual sets. So is that from a practicality standpoint in terms of time and editing and processing, or is that just capturing that realism and that feeling that we're really there?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, there's definitely a point at which sets become much more time-saving than CGI. You save time in production doing green screen, but you burn time in post-production. And then you also have to worry about, is this shot really going to look real when it's done? So I'm going to pour in countless hours rendering a scene, and it might not even look that good. Or I can spend countless hours building the set that I know will look good the moment I press record. So there's definitely a production element, but there's also, we really do want tactile sets. We feel like the entire point of the movie, or not the entire point, but a big point of the movie kind of disintegrates when you don't have real sets, mm-hmm. You don't have real environments. And assuredly, we're going to definitely be doing digital set extensions. You know, we might only build 10 feet of a corridor and we'll have a green screen at the end of it. That's much different than doing the entire thing digitally.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, that's interesting to know as well. So let's talk about the Kickstarter campaign. I looked at the breakdown of your budget here, and you're truly doing this on a budget, especially $5,000 for sets, $2,000 for costumes and props. You're going to be very creative in how you put things together, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. I was talking earlier about the costumes, for instance. We need something like 15 costumes, or 15 Starfleet costumes and like 4 or 5 Romulan costumes. And it sounds cheap, but we feel like a lot of people probably wouldn't even notice if I didn't tell you. But when we're making the Starfleet costumes, you know, they're layered. We have the black undershirt and the colored sweater. But when we have our actors in dress uniform, they're going to be wearing shirts and ties underneath. So we don't actually need to build dress uniforms. We can just wear the duty uniform with a different shirt underneath and, oh, it's a dress uniform. And we don't feel that, you know, they both look believable. They both look good, in my opinion. I don't think that's cheapening the vision, but it's also saving money. And I try to channel a lot of the original series art department when I'm thinking of costumes and sets and props. Like, what can I repurpose? What can, you know, you see costumes, you see props get reused all the time in the original series. And I think that's kind of part of the magic. I don't think that's cheap so much as, like, I don't know what the word for it is. But with the sets as well, we're actually only building one set, but we're actually going to be building 50 sets because the set, the bridge set, is 100% modular, and the back wall of the bridge is actually flat, and the consoles will roll up right up next to it. So, you know, the original series bridge kind of has a very jagged profile. If you think about the ceiling, the, you know, the roof, the wall, the console, you can't really reuse that for anything. But if we have a flat back and we roll things up to it, we actually have, you know, the bridge is kind of built on an octagon. We actually have 8 wall segments. We have 8 console segments, and we have 8 corner segments that kind of space things into the octagon. So that's actually a number of set elements we can rearrange. You know, the big view screen elements, there are 3 of them. If you take the screen element out, they're windows. So we can actually create a room with windows using what was originally for the view screen on the bridge. So we actually have, you know, an unlimited number of sets in just that one set. And that's why our set can be $5,000, because we can build a respectable bridge set for $5,000 and then reuse it a million times for every other set in the movie. And I would bet real money that nobody's going to realize that we're reusing pieces, because we're going to be redressing pieces. You know, wall segments are going to have different pipes or different buttons on them, and you won't tell.
Yeah. Well, things get repurposed all the time, even in TNG and DS9 and Voyager.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people typically don't notice unless you tell them and they're really looking for it. And then they'll go, oh, yeah, now I can see that. One thing that was really interesting to me was in Star Trek Into Darkness, where the bridge of the Vengeance is the bridge of the Enterprise, absolutely. And they just painted everything black. And on the Blu-ray, they show them painting everything black. And when you're watching the movie, you don't think about that at all. And then you realize, well,
it's very, it's just you can't even tell. Even when people tell you that it's the same bridge, it's hard to tell.
It and just that's, feels that's so different, yeah.
Very much what we're going to be doing. So we don't have other bridges that we're going to be showing, but it's the same idea. We can have entirely different parts of the ship using the exact same pieces. And we feel, you know, maybe we can angle the walls in, you know, in one set and then that sort of thing. And we don't actually have to build new sets. So that's how we can do it on $5,000.
Well, tell me a bit more about the Kickstarter. Now, your total goal is $20,000. And it's important, of course, for us to point out that about 10%, 20% of that ends up going into fees, right? You've got
10% is fees and then another perks. 10% we've budgeted for perks.
Right.
Now, we could have said, you know, 5% for perks and been really stingy about it.
But the point is, people should understand that a lot of money goes to fees and perk fulfillment when we
absolutely. We only if we make 20,000, we only get 16,000.
Yeah. That's something often don't think about, I believe. So,
right.
But your goal is 20,000, and we already mentioned 5,000 for sets, 2,000 for costumes, and then the other 9,000 is for equipment. So tell everyone what else they need to know about the Kickstarter, where the money's going, and how that's going to help you get this film out.
Well, the budget breakdown on our site is pretty accurate as far as where the money is going. Though where the mystery comes in is if we make more than our goal, which I would really like to do, because even though we've really budgeted with like extremely budget conscious mentality, it would be
really nice if we had a little bit extra. Yeah. Like if we actually had 20,000 rather than 16,000, so we'd have to make, you know, 25,000 on the Kickstarter. So like we could actually, for instance, invest in a tailor for our uniforms and stuff like that, rather than just us, you know, learning how to sew and making, you know, stuff like that. Little things that we think would go a long way, or we could buy a 3D printer and fabricate props much easier, much more easily. Stuff like that.
That's what Tommy Craft is doing with Horizon, is 3D printing props. Yep.
Right. Yeah. And that's something I've envied. You know, I've been in contact with Tommy and he's done some, you know, he printed our preliminary phaser.
Oh, he did.
And I love it. Cool. Yeah. Which gets a brief cameo in the Kickstarter video. But it would be really nice to be able to do that kind of stuff in shop when we need little things on, you know, at a moment's notice. Stuff like that. And also compensating people for gas money. We have interest as far out as Ohio, and we're in Pennsylvania, and that's like a 6-hour drive. That would be very difficult for an actor if, you know, or, a, you know, a valuable crew member coming 6 hours. We would like to be able to say, hey, we can cover you, or, hey, we'll have a nice warm meal here for you. You know, we can do our own craft services and stuff like that, which are currently not in the budget. That would come right out of our pockets. But if we made more than our budget, we could alleviate some of the financial stress on people making food, people traveling, stuff like that. And that would be very nice.
Well, tell us about some of the perks that you have available. I really like these rank insignia.
Yeah, I'm really excited about those. We were thinking about getting those 3D printed, but we're actually going to get them die cut out of steel.
Okay.
Just like the badges. It'll be, you know, it'll feel really good holding a, you know, a steel badge or a steel pin in your hands. So for the perks, what we wanted to do was offer people things that are actually like a part of the movie. Like we could offer t-shirts, we could offer bumper stickers or magnets or, you know, any number of things. But, you know, these are the literal badges that are going on our uniforms. These are the literal rank pins and patches and stuff like that.
So people are going to be getting not replicas, but they're going to be getting the rank insignia that you're using for the shooting.
It's possible. There's not going to be a number enough to say that every single one is screen used.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Though it's possible. I don't think we would just hang on to that kind of stuff. It would be more like a lottery kind of bonus. Like, by the way, this one was actually used on screen. But most of them will be replicas in the sense that they weren't filmed on screen, but they're cut, you know, out of the same order of the ones we used on screen. But it's still something that's kind of a part of that universe. You're holding that thing rather than... It's not merchandise.
Right,
it's straight out of the 23rd century, that sort of thing. That's kind of the vibe we wanted.
Excellent. And so you have things like that, badges, rank pins, medallions, like Romulan medallions.
Oh, right. The Romulan badge as well. That'll be exciting. We were kind of hoping that somebody, if you scroll all the way down to the $10,000 reward, it's more of a joke, but there's a gold plated one in there.
Right.
You can get it gold plated. And I was kind of hoping somebody would get that just so I could hold it and then, you know, mail it.
That would be cool. Of course, you have the other things that are common on film Kickstarters, like associate producer credits, executive producer, a chance to actually appear in the film or come behind the scenes. And you have another really cool thing that you're writing, correct, which is the technical manual to the Pacific. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's something I kind of just wanted to do as like my own fan fiction, because there's so much detail in that ship that nobody's ever going to see. For instance, the shuttle bay on the Pacific has a really unique, like, rotating rack that holds shuttle pods.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. And so it's like a parking garage here in Tokyo, right? Where you put the car in and it goes up through, yeah.
Exactly. We thought, you know, the secondary hull is cylindrical. Why aren't we taking, like, why do we just have a flat surface to land ships? Like, they should be, like, in some kind of... So there's actually, and that's fully rigged in the 3D model. Like we can actually rotate a shuttle pod out and launch them, you know, virtually. But sadly, it's not in the script.
Okay.
it's just a detail because I wanted to flesh out the ship. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of spaces on the ship that would never ever get seen on screen, but they're designed in like the where I place windows and where I place certain elements, external details are actually indicative of internal details that I just want to show off because that's detail that's in this ship. And I wanted to write a technical manual anyway. So I thought it would be really fun to offer that. And especially since I'm going to be doing a lot of consultation, like my father is a pilot, for instance, and he's advised like light placement, you know, all Star Trek ships tend to have the red and the green navigational lights, but most of the ships don't have accurate collision lights. They don't have accurate nose and tail lights, and the Pacific does. So that kind of stuff.
That's very cool. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out, or at least hearing more about it. I don't know if I probably won't have my hands on it physically, but because that's, are you going to have many copies of that, or is it just going to be a perk? Is that going to be something that people can get later on, like through a donor store or something?
I think it's going to, after the Kickstarter is done, We are definitely going to have a PayPal donation site set up.
Okay.
Where you can get almost all the Kickstarter perks and then probably individual Kickstarter perks that we didn't offer on the Kickstarter. Okay. Like you can just buy the batch.
Okay. So the way Axanar is doing their donor store, that's a great
right,
way
yeah.
to.
So if people just want the technical manual, the bound technical manual, which is available at the $700 perk where you get everything plus the technical manual, we might offer the technical manual as a standalone, just the technical manual. Not entirely sure, though.
Because I know quite a few fans out there who would love just that because they're really, really into those technical details of ships. So that's very cool. All right. Well, your Kickstarter is, you have 21 days to go from the time we are recording this.
That's right. And so
it ends on, okay, so when I look at Kickstarter, I always see Japan time. So for me, it ends on September 21st. What's the actual end date in the U.S.?
It ends September 20th,
okay.
At 11:59 Eastern time.
Okay, great. And right now, you have 163 backers, 8,729. So you're closing in on halfway to that goal. Still 21 days to go. So you're on a good pace to hit this.
Yep.
So if people want to contribute to that, of course, just go to kickstarter.com, type Pacific 201 in, it's going to come right up. But beyond the Kickstarter, if people want to know more, such as on Facebook or your website or YouTube, where should they go for that?
Well, I typically direct people straight to our website, pacific201.com, because there are links to Facebook, YouTube, there's a link to the Kickstarter there, and we also have articles about the movie. There's like an article about the ship. There's an article about, you know, how we came to the Romulan logo that we're using in the movie, stuff like that. So Pacific201.com, all the links you need, plus cool information.
Excellent. Well, it's a really cool project, Eric, and I hope people come out and support you on this. And do you have any final words before we go? Why people need to come out and make sure that the Pacific flies?
I just like to remind people that Pacific 201 is all about the dream of Star Trek. Join the dream of the final frontier. That's Pacific 201. So if you really want to see something that kind of recaptures the optimism and the hope and the wonder of Star Trek, I feel like Pacific 201 is definitely a project for you.
Fantastic. And also, if people want to find you, are you around in social media? Are you a social media person?
I am on social media. I mean, a lot of people friend request me on Facebook. I don't really do that so much. Facebook I use mostly for instant messaging, just to talk with people.
Yeah, I do that too.
So Nobody's really going to benefit much from friend requesting me. But I do have a website, echenry.com, and I have a contact form there. And you're free to contact me through there. I like to be prompt with my responses, and I try to be friendly. So That's how you can get a little closer to me.
Excellent. All right. Well, Eric, thanks again for all your time today, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the project evolves.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, that was really interesting talking to Eric about Pacific 201. It really is a unique Star Trek project. And if you go over to his Kickstarter page and check out the video and all the information, I think you'll probably agree. I'd also like to remind everyone that this show and Talk of Fan Projects is just one of the many shows we have here on the network. and just one of the many topics that we talk about. We have shows covering every corner of the Star Trek universe. Every single series has a dedicated show. Science, creative beyond Star Trek, books, comics, you name it, we're talking about it here. In fact, stick with me here for a minute and let me share with you some of the other things that we've been talking about on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Well, it's very small and intimate, and you get to see, you know, a lot of people whose work you've come to admire or whatever, and I mean, that's what's kind of cool about it. The fact that it's in a hotel, it's at the Rio, and, you know, everyone is staying there.
Earl Grey.
Yeah, really, she's following the Hasbrat, I think, is really what it is.
Come for the revolution, stay for the Hasbrat.
It's got to be fresh Hasbrat. None of that replicated stuff.
Like, Daniel's like, at the watching the end of this episode, like, tears are coming down the face. It's like, oh, it's the Hasbrat. It's so spicy. It's what it is.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which, when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew, pew, pew. I promise you that.
To the journey! I do have one honorable mention.
Name it.
Pax!
Oh, how could we not have a top five season five moments without Prax?
Warp 5.
It kind of like is akin to when fans saw the Galaxy class in The Next Generation for the very first time, and you had basically a crew and civilian complement of, what, over 1,000 people? About two-thirds of that complement were civilians and their families. So you actually did have teachers and scholars and scientists and their extended families on board.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
One of the things that amazes me about the score for Star Trek The Motion Picture is that he only had 50% of the movie available to him when he scored. So he was scoring an awful lot to scene missing, scene missing.
The 602 Club.
Where did he get the cloak from on the other planet? I really, really, really want to know. He shows up with the cloak.
He kind of fashioned it out of a rudimentary lathe.
Literary Treks.
It's a small point, but I thought it was really interesting to have here in the book, because again, that's what Star Trek Deep Space Nine has really always done for Star Trek, which is kind of make faith okay in the Star Trek universe and show how it's valid. And so I thought that was a really nice, and it, again, it's a tiny point in the book, but I thought it was pretty powerful, at least for me, who is somebody who is of faith. So
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters, that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969. That had its moment. It had its time. And there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward, because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Keiko could totally beat the crap out of Rumpelstiltskin. This is so, like, I cannot buy this at all. That she's just sitting there being like, oh, my baby.
At the very least, she could throw a plant at him or something. Because we established in TNG that pot poo is a thing.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So as you can hear, we have a huge family here at Trek FM, and you can get our shows everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, go to iTunes.com/Trek FM, and that'll take you right over to our artist section in the iTunes store, whether that's on the desktop or in the podcasts app on your iOS device. We are very honored to be a featured provider with Apple and iTunes, and we really thank Apple for all the space they've given us there in the store. Now, if you're not an Apple user, you can find us on Android, of course. There are great apps on Android, like Pocket Casts. You can just search for Trek FM and Star Trek, and we'll come right up. Search for the name of the show. You can also go to our website and stream. You can grab the RSS link. You can find us in SoundCloud, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone. We're all over the place. So check out the shows wherever you are. And again, if you're an iTunes user, you can really help us out by leaving a star rating and a written review for the show there in the store. We love to hear from you, and that also influences how we place in search results and makes it easier for Star Trek fans to find the show. By the way, I am really honored that this show has been selected as a Parsec Awards finalist this year. All of our shows were nominated, and we really thank everyone who supported us and nominated us. And Continuing Mission is a finalist, also The Ready Room, The 602 Club, Women at Warp, Axanar, the official podcast, and Literary Treks. We have six shows that are finalists, and those are going to be announced at Dragon Con in Atlanta, September 4th through 7th. I'm looking forward to seeing if we win anything. It'll be a great honor if we do. We have some great competition that we're up against. And bottom line for me, just the fact that podcasting is getting that recognition and this show is getting that recognition, that alone is an honor. And so congrats to everyone who is a finalist. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we are a listener-supported network, and we do need your help to keep our programming coming. So if you'd like to support us, if you'd like to become part of the team, there are options for that as well, at patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. We already have 69 supporters as of the moment I'm recording this who contribute money that helps us cover the cost of production, hosting, and distribution. It costs a lot to run this network, and we hope that you'll support us as well. Every little bit counts. We love everyone who listens, of course, and everyone who supports us. So please go check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. Now, if you'd like to leave some feedback on today's show, I would love to hear from you. You can find us on iTunes. Our username is trekfm. You can also go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to a show, choose Continuing Mission, and that'll come to me by email. If you're on Facebook, we have a brand page, facebook.com/trekfm, and we also have a wonderful listeners group called the Babel Conference. We have almost 800 people in that group right now. It's a closed group. You just need to go there and click join, and we'll let you right in. If you type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, you'll find us there, or go to our website and click discussion. We have really great, respectful discussions there, like the ones we have here on the network. I think it's really unique in social media and on Facebook, what we've created there. I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud of having everyone in there as members and how everyone conducts themselves. And I hope you'll join us. Again, that's the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, on Facebook. Now, if you'd like to find me personally, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook, and I'm there in the Babel Conference. Elsewhere on the network, I do a few other shows. You can find me doing The Ready Room, where I'm joined by other hosts from the network and special guests, and we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series, as well as Star Trek news. Matthew Rushing and I do a show together called The Orb. That's all about Deep Space Nine. I also occasionally do a new show called Hyperchannel, and I produce the official podcast of Axanar, which is hosted by Alec Peters and Robert Meyer Burnett here on the network. Now, if you would like to find my writing on Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at StarTrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives, and I'll have a new one out just by the time the show drops, probably any day now, there should be a new column out. My current one is about taking three-story arcs like were used in the fourth season of Enterprise and applying that to the next generation. And what would that look like? I think it's kind of an interesting concept. So again, you can find that over on StarTrek.com. And if you just, for some reason, like listening to me podcast and listening to me talk, I also do a podcast that's not about Star Trek. It's called Metropolis On Air. It's connected with the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. And I interview people on there as well about all sorts of topics. I mean, wide range of topics, entertainment, sports, all kinds of things. It's also about life in Japan, life in Tokyo, some Japanese language lessons, and all sorts of other stuff. We just have fun on that show. And you can find that in iTunes by searching Metropolis On Air, or go to our website, metropolisjapan.com, and you'll find it there. Oh, I also have my own website, cbrianjones.com. I try to write on there about things other than Star Trek, so check that out too, if you'd like. All right. Well, thanks for listening today, everyone, and thank you to Eric for his time tonight sharing all the details about Pacific 201 with us. I hope you'll go support him and check out what he's doing with that project. It's really awesome. And then join me again next time here on this continuing mission, and let's see what's out there.